How to Survive the Darkest Year of the Dark Ages. Let's say you want to see the Dark Ages at their darkest. You want to peer into this opaque era for yourself and see what Europe was like after the Roman retreat. You want to see the Britons wage their titanic resistance against the invading Anglo-Saxons and investigate whether the mythical Briton leader King Arthur really existed and really killed 960 men in a single battle, as the legends claim. So you travel back to March 24, 536, to the hill fort of South Cadbury, one of the rumored sites for Camelot. You see the vestiges of the Roman Empire, the Christian churches, the Roman roads and forts. You hear Latin still spoken by the city's elite, but Britonic on its streets. You observe the ramparts, the huge dining hall, the knights and their horses. And sometime on that March day, you see the sun pass behind a cloud and not emerge for nearly a decade. You have arrived not only in the darkest year of the Dark Ages, but Harvard medieval historian Michael McCormick tells me he believes the year 536 to be the single worst year in human history. On March 24, 536, a cloud obscured the sun and the earth plunged into thermal shock. Global temperatures dropped 5 degrees Fahrenheit. In the northern latitudes, they dropped by as much as 10. Tree ring analysis suggests the next decade was the coldest in 2,500 years. Snows fell in Baghdad. Blizzards raged through the summer in eastern China. The perpetual cloud didn't merely chill the planet. It set off a series of dramatic feedback loops, reducing evaporation and dropping the planet into a global drought that shrunk the equatorial zone to a mere sliver. Few pieces of writing survive from this dark age, but what has suggests catastrophe across the entire northern hemisphere. The Byzantine historian Procopius writes, "The sun gave forth its light without brightness, like the moon, during this whole year, and it seemed exceedingly like the sun in eclipse, for the beams it shed were not clear, nor such as it is accustomed to shed. And from the time when this thing happened, men were free neither from war, nor pestilence, nor any other thing leading to death." According to Roman Senator Cassiodorus, 536 brought a winter without storms, a spring without mildness, and a summer without heat. Michael the Syrian, author of the 12th century medieval chronicle, wrote, "Each day the sun shone for about 4 hours, and still this light was only a feeble shadow. Everyone declared the sun would never recover its full light. The fruits did not ripen, and the wine tasted like sour grapes." According to ancient Chinese records, a kingdom north of the Yellow River suffered such severe summer snows and droughts in 536, 537, and 538 that as much as 80% of the population died during the resulting famine. Archaeological evidence from the 6th century suggests villagers across Scotland, Ireland, and Scandinavia abandoned their farming communities entirely. The cause of the cloud was a supermassive volcanic eruption, followed quickly by two more. In an unprecedented series of volcanic activity, evidence from ice cores prove at least 3 different massive volcanoes erupted in 536, 540, and 547 that combined to produce the greatest episode of atmospheric obfuscation in human history. In 1783, Benjamin Franklin postulated that a volcanic eruption could alter global weather when he wondered whether Iceland's erupting Mount Hekla might be responsible for that year's persistent dry fog. The rays of the sun were rendered so faint in passing through it that when collected in the focus of a burning glass, they would scarce kindle brown paper. In his reflection titled Meteorological Imaginations and Conjectures, Franklin presciently went on to wonder whether it had happened before. It seems, however, worth the inquiry whether other hard winters, recorded in history, were preceded by similar permanent and widely extended summer fogs, he wrote. 300 years later, historians realized just how spectacularly correct he was. Though they had for centuries been aware of the written testimonies of the eyewitnesses to year 536, like Procopius and Cassiodorus, we had largely dismissed them as hysterical, McCormick says. That began to change in the late 1990s when scientists analyzed ancient tree rings, the width of which they used to infer ancient climates, and discovered a remarkable consistency across the Northern Hemisphere, beginning in the year 536 and continuing for the next decade. Tree rings evidenced extreme growth anomalies. Not only did their widths testify to extremely poor growing seasons, they showed evidence of summer frosts. Still, it wasn't until 2015, when analysis of ice cores showed a decade-long spike of sulfuric pollution that, McCormick explains, historians developed a consensus around the climatological catastrophe that occurred. The ash found in the ice cores chemically matched Icelandic rocks, which suggests that the cloud that darkened the sky that March day must have been a volcanic haze from an as-yet-undetermined caldera on that Atlantic island. The massive eruption blasted 70 cubic miles of ash and earth into the atmosphere and at least 100 megatons of sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere. The ash and dirt fell to earth within weeks, but the sulfur dioxide combined with water to create tiny sulfuric acid aerosols. These droplets buffeted in the high winds of the stratosphere, creating a dry, sun-shielding volcanic haze that remained aloft for years. This fog reflected so much light that the sun shone with only 10% of its normal power in the mornings and evenings, according to anthropologist Joel Gunn, author of The Years Without Summer, Tracing AD 536 and Its Aftermath. Then, 4 years later, it happened again. In 540, a second volcano, this time somewhere closer to the equator, perhaps El Salvador's Iopango, erupted in what was the largest blast of the past 7,000 years. While the 536 eruption primarily affected the Northern Hemisphere, Iopango affected the entire globe. 7 years later, in 547, a third blast, believed to have occurred somewhere in Indonesia, again polluted the stratosphere with a sulfuric haze. Thanks to a series of poorly understood climatological feedback loops, the climactic cooling lasted for more than a century, but the severest effects occurred immediately. Crops failed across the Northern Hemisphere. In Northern Europe, the number of good growing days dropped by half. In Stockholm, the number of occupied sites fell by more than 75%. Farming villages became ghost towns. In southern Norway, the population fell by nearly half. The same pattern emerges in the archaeological record across what is now Denmark, Estonia, and northern Germany. The Irish Annals of Innisfallen note a failure of bread for the years 536 to 539. The Scots living in Ireland and the Picts of Scotland abandoned their farms entirely, relocated to the coast, and became fishermen. All archaeological and weather simulations suggest that in the decade following 536, Northern Europe suffered one of the worst famines in recorded history. Cities are particularly dangerous in medieval famines, and remember, you're in one of Britain's largest. You would think a sophisticated center of commerce and trade would insulate you from the famine compared to its effects on a rural farmer. You would be wrong. At first, the local king, Arthur, distributed the grains he collected and stored in case of bad growing seasons. True famines were rare in the early Middle Ages, but food shortages were common, and a principal role for a king was to supply his people in times of dearth. Even in the best of times, farming in Northern Europe was difficult and inefficient. Staple crop cereals like rye and wheat suffered a bad growing season every 1 year in four. There was no heavy plow, no crop rotation, and no proper fertilizers, so the average yield per seed of wheat sown was under 4. Today, it's over 40. In a large fort like South Cadbury, the king may have stored enough grain to sustain his people for a single bad year, but in medieval Europe, there were no resources nor the governmental sophistication to deal with extended dearth. In pre-modern times, no medieval society could store enough grain to last two consecutive bad years, so when the fog persisted, and the year without summer stretched into the years without summer, Britons went from eating very little to eating the bark off trees. Medieval cities like South Cadbury became death traps in famines. Urban residents relied on trade to feed themselves, and famines killed economies. As the food supply dwindled, the demand for what remained skyrocketed. Citizens had to reallocate everything they had toward purchasing what little food they could afford. As they did, demand for anything non-edible cratered. cobblers, smiths, tailors, and the rest of the urban professions who drive city commerce lost their customers, jobs, and homes. Cities became impoverished. Bringing food into the city in the best of times was already expensive. In 6th century Britain, every 50 miles that a product had to travel over land doubled its price. In famine, that problem only worsened. When feed became too expensive, herders slaughtered their animals. Without refrigeration, Britons used salt to keep their meat, but at the same time, demand for salt rose. The dimming sun reduced evaporation. Market specifics don't exist for the famine of 536, but in the medieval Great Famine of 1315, the price of salt quadrupled in less than a year when the drop in production combined with the increased demand. Without salt, excess meat goes to rot, and dairies cannot produce their milk and cheese. With no demand for their product, tradespeople sold everything they owned for food, including their land. The very wealthy scooped up real estate at rock-bottom prices, while everyone else looked for work where there was none and eventually ate food that wasn't really food. When 1 year of fog turns into two, when crops fail for the second time, when your local grain stores run dry, you'll begin what historian William Chester Jordan calls the strange diet of medieval destitution. In the early stages of the famine, you'll eat animals that are not normally consumed, including, in rough order of descent, milking cows, ewes, horses, followed by pets, and eventually, rats. When the animals are gone, you'll begin to eat rotten food, perhaps not even knowingly. Desperate merchants may begin to pollute the food they sell with disgusting, indigestible matter to make dwindling supplies last. In Paris, during the Great Famine, local bakers cut their product with wine dregs and pig droppings. If you try to ride out the famine as a baker, don't do this. When the swindled townsfolk discovered the baker's trickery, they tortured them. Once your diet descends to rotten matter, you've entered a dangerous stage. As tempting as rotten food may become, you should avoid it. In medieval famines, rotten food killed more people than true starvation. Most died from parasitic diseases or dysentery that they contracted by eating diseased food. Villagers ate grain infested with fungi like ergot, which grows on rye after cold summers and causes excruciating intestinal pain followed by death. Today, it's called ergotism, but in medieval times it was known as St. Anthony's Fire, and the cause was a mystery. Make sure to check your grain for signs of black fungus, or you may spend your final weeks in extreme stomach pain. Starving citizens scavenged dung heaps on the outskirts of towns, contracted intestinal diseases their already weakened bodies couldn't overcome, died on the streets and in the fields, and were buried in mass graves. In an effort to maintain employment, you should consider the famine-proof profession of hauling away the bodies of the deceased. The city of Bruges, Belgium, paid 16 pence per body disposed in the Great Famine of 1315, though the less densely populated South Cadbury probably won't be hiring. In famine's final stage, you'll eat natural products that are not normally thought of as edible, such as roots, sprigs, leaves, and even bark. Many paupers grazed like cows on the growing grasses of the fields, reported one contemporary chronicler of medieval famine. Once you're eating grass, death by disease, dysentery, or starvation will soon follow. A better option is to leave the city entirely. As local villagers watch their crops fail and they flock to the city, you should switch places with them. In the Great Famine, the rural villages fared far better than the urban areas. This seems counterintuitive, as cities would seem to provide safety in numbers, but it is exactly the opposite. In famines, density becomes dangerous. The smaller the community, the more easily you can survive off the land. While in the city you would be forced to eat whatever detritus you find on the street, in the villages you can supplement your diet with hunting and gathering. You might also have some success farming by adapting to the chill. When I asked Joel Gunn what you should plant, he suggested cold-resistant crops like rye or barley rather than emmer wheat. Unfortunately, drought, cold, fog, and famine aren't the only reasons 536 is the worst year in human history. Instead, the cold has another, even more horrific effect. High in the Tibetan plateau, the chill and drought forced bubonic plague. carrying rodents into the more populated lowlands, where they infected traders. These traders ferried the plague west and brought it with them in their boats down the Nile. In 541, the disease arrived in the Egyptian port city of Pelusium. From there, sea merchants spread it throughout the Mediterranean. The novel bacterium exploded through the naive population. The plague hit Constantinople, the densely populated capital city of the Eastern Roman Empire, with particular fury. An estimated 30% of the city's more than 500,000 people died in the pandemic known as the Justinianic Plague. Once among the Romans and their ships, the disease spread throughout their vast trading network. The archaeological record suggests the plague barely touched the Anglo-Saxons, probably because they didn't trade with the empires in the Eastern Mediterranean, nor with anyone else on the mainland continent. But the Britons did. The Briton culture maintained a healthy trade with cities of the Eastern Roman Empire, who valued their copper and iron ore and exchanged it for fine Mediterranean wines and other luxury Roman goods. In all likelihood, Yersinia Pestis traveled aboard one of these Roman trading ships and struck the killing blow the Anglo-Saxons couldn't. After centuries of stalemate, within a few years of the plague's arrival, the Anglo-Saxons swept across southern England, which had until recently been occupied and defended by powerful hill forts like South Cadbury. After famine and plague, these cities stood as shells of their former selves. One 8th-century Anglo-Saxon poem titled The Ruin describes the carnage their armies found in the Britons' forts. Days of pestilence came. Death swept away all the bravery of men. Their fortresses became waste places. The city fell to ruin. The multitudes who might have built it anew lay dead on the earth. To reiterate, you should leave the Briton city. All evidence suggests South Cadbury suffered a devastating annihilation. When the volcanic cloud passes in front of the sun, your only hope will be to abandon not only the cities, but also the Britons. You need to commit the ultimate betrayal and take up with the enemy, the invading, Odin-worshipping, Old English-speaking Anglo-Saxons. You'll have to accustom yourself to their different ways. They live on simple family farms rather than in urban cities. They worship the same Germanic gods that inspired the Vikings, such as Thor, god of thunder. They do speak English, but that doesn't mean you'll understand them. Their ancient version is as different from modern English as German is today, so at best you'll pick out a word or two. But perhaps, with some practice, you may eventually speak it well enough to ask questions. Just don't ask them about King Arthur. That might be a touchy subject.